is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Becky Hogg. Welcome to tonight's edition of Little Atoms with me, Becky Hogg. This evening I'm with Ian Brown and Chris Marsden, authors of Regulating Code. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Helping me interview Chris and Ian will be technology pundit Bill Thompson, who is going to tell us a little bit more about tonight's guests.
Well, with us tonight we've got Chris Marsden, who's Professor of Media Law at the University of Sussex. He's author of Net Neutrality, Towards a Co-Regulatory Solution, Internet Co-Regulation, and three other books, probably about the same sort of theme. Ian Brown is Associate Director of Oxford's Cyber Security Centre and a Senior Research Fellow at the Oxford Internet Institute. He's Editor of the Research Handbook on the Governance of the Internet. Together, they're authors of Regulating Code, out now from MIT Press. And the book takes on the old platitudes about the Internet, like Stuart Brown's observation that information wants to be free, and John Gilmore's assertion that the net interprets censorship as damage and roots around it, and tries to reveal the real political conditions and the regulatory environments that are shaping communications technology and through the wider world. So I suppose I'd like to start by asking, why do we need this book now?
I think we need the book now because there's been a great many books published in the last 4 or 5 years about the internet, mainly actually from an American perspective, written by a lot of American lawyers who explain how we can solve problems without the state having to have an obvious role.
And you're not American, Chris.
I'm not American, that's right. You can probably spot by the accent. And so we felt it was very important to actually explain how in European conditions, the book is much more about Europe than it is about the UK individually, because of course the internet is international and policy is set at a European level. So we were very keen to actually have a book that brought home to Europeans where we think we can do things as netizens, but also our governments hopefully can do things for us to actually improve conditions rather than just crossing our fingers and hoping that some new technology will somehow remove the problems, because that hasn't been happening so far.
Is that how you feel about it as well, Ian?
Absolutely, and I think there's been a lot of discussion in the last 15 to 20 years of net politics about how government is the problem, government should just get out of the way, you know, in a way, although the net politicians probably wouldn't like the comparison, a very Ronald Reagan, quite hardcore libertarian philosophy. And Chris and I are hardly raving socialists, but we do see that there is a role for collective action for the state, particularly in protecting fundamental human rights that not just Americans, but Europeans and, of course, citizens in many other countries want protected, not just freedom of expression, but also things like privacy, where you see in Europe, actually, there's a strong role for the state to play.
You take on sort of five core topics in the book, and the first one is, as you say, privacy and data protection. At the end of that chapter, you conclude that actually the citizen is almost absent in terms of fighting for their own rights online, and actually the state has a big role to play. I wondered if you could expand on that a little bit.
So privacy is a very interesting policy area, I think, where you see in the US a real drawback from the idea that all we have to do is have transparency. So, of course, everyone reads the 50-page terms and conditions and contracts and so on at every website they go to. Of course they don't. Even if they did, most people wouldn't have the first idea what they were actually signing away. Secondly, there are some really interesting research findings over the last 5 to 10 years that say actually people on their own are quite bad at making privacy-related decisions. People in general, I mean, just like children will grab the lolly today rather than wait for the two lollies tomorrow, actually adults make the same mistakes all the time, that they will go for the short-term immediate benefit, i.e. you sign up to the social networking site, you get to share cat photos with your friends and go to all the cool parties, whereas the potential costs are longer term, they're probabilistic, so you're not sure if the drunken party photo you put up today is going to be seen by your future employer, or perhaps some information you give to friends is going to influence the decision of an insurance company or perhaps a bank in not giving you a mortgage in 10 years.
And how about you, Chris? I mean, do you specialise in privacy? Is this an area that is an interest of yours in the past?
It's interesting. The book is co-written all the way through, even though we obviously have our individual areas. You talked about my net neutrality work and other things. Ian is more the expert on privacy than I am. And I should say that we perhaps didn't say at the outset that, of course, Ian's a computer scientist writing about policy better than lawyers, to our chagrin. I'm a lawyer trying to apply as much as I can of socio-legal work to what we're doing. So we're working from different disciplines together. And I should say that one of the problems we have, because I'm conscious that anyone listening to the show might be throwing things at the radio at this point, saying, my God, they're going to be talking about how government is the answer to every problem that we have. We should say that one of the things that, I think privacy is a good example of this, one of the important elements of government to understand is how to make legislation more intelligent so that you don't simply put a law forward which is unenforceable or which doesn't work in the interests of the internet's own future, in other words, that works against the engineering of the internet. And so privacy would be a case in point, and so would the other case studies, where if legislators are going to come up with laws, they better make sure the laws they come up with are actually going to be, how should we put it, technologically literate, I think, is a basic ambition.
That's certainly a very strong theme throughout the book of expressing the fact that governments don't necessarily understand what it is they're interfering with. I notice you use the word government there, but within the book you talk about governance.
Mm-hmm.
And is that an important distinction, do you think, in trying to appreciate how we can regulate the internet and the code of the internet?
This is where we talk about civil society and multi-stakeholders, and I'm trying to think of a way of expressing this without coming up with a lot of cliches that some of your listeners will be very familiar with. So we're very conscious of the fact that there are many different stakeholders involved in these policy debates. Now, very often the policy debates, unfortunately, get funneled down to a point where corporations say this is what we'd like to do, and governments who are ignorant of the or even careless of the policy outcome say, okay, if that's what corporations want, that's what we'll do. But of course, there are various other stakeholders involved as well. There is us, as citizens, with more or less knowledge of the internet and more or less experience on the internet. There are, of course, the engineers on, who actually help to set the standards for the internet as well. And so if you don't involve these groups as broadly as possible, you'll end up making really bad law. And so governments on their own won't be enough. Governance is about getting everybody at the table. This may sound a little bit as if we're all going to hold hands and come up with the perfect solution, but you do have to have real inputs from everybody. And that isn't just having a consultation for 12 weeks at the end of a lawmaking period. That's about getting people involved at the beginning of the process so you don't come up with really stupid ideas like the Communications Data Bill, or at this point we can insert whichever favourite stupid law we'd like to mention.
At the end of the second chapter, for example, you call the regulation of copyright online, quote, an abject lesson in damage caused to the public interest by allowing self-interested industry groups to drive policy. We have in this country here the Digital Economy Act. We've seen similar threats to disconnect alleged infringers in France and other European countries. How has that happened, and what prospects are there for change in the future?
Well, copyright is interesting because you often hear people talking about the impact of the internet on policy in terms of it changes everything, you know, it's sort of year zero in policy terms. And actually that is rarely true if you look carefully. But I think copyright is one of the areas where the internet has had a really revolutionary impact, because of course most people in advanced economies like the UK now have multiple digital printing presses in their homes, their personal computers and laptops and MP3 players, and they have a virtually cost-free means of distribution out to the world via peer-to-peer systems on the internet. So what's gone from something where actually that closed behind-the-scenes government industry sort of stitch-up model of policymaking, which sort of worked pre-internet, really no longer does, because copyright really affects all internet users very strongly. We've seen groups in the last 10 to 15 years in the US and more recently in Europe, so the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the US, then groups like the Open Rights Group in the UK and other similar European groups, try to get themselves into the policy making debate and process. They've made some progress, but as we saw with what happened with the Digital Economy Act, of course, was there was a debate going, and then the government rammed through the bill in the dying days of the last parliament without having that consensus. And I think the mess that we ended up with shows the folly of that approach.
Mm. And it's interesting on that in fact, the actual notice and then throttling procedure that the government suggested at that time hasn't been implemented yet by Ofcom, probably won't be before the next election, because it is so unworkable, and the regulators are not very happy with the idea of trying to.
Chris, the chapter about in the book about censorship, the third chapter, uses a word listeners won't be familiar with, but that appears in titles of two of your previous books. I'm talking about co-regulation. I wonder, could you tell us what that word means and how it applies to the way censorship is developed online?
Yes, co-regulation is the idea that self-regulation, which is of course normally exercised by industry, by the your and my favourite corporates, are only allowed to exercise that self-regulatory scheme under authorisation by government, or with the threat, and I should say this is an explicit threat, that government can step in and implement their own scheme if the self-regulatory scheme is inadequate. So in other words, this is not simply government saying you're in the last chance saloon, you'll have to do something effective, otherwise we're going to get very cross. This is government actually having legislation in place that says we are in a position where we can impose our solution if the self-regulatory solution doesn't work in practice. And I'll give you an example of where that operates. In the Digital Economy Act, there are exactly these provisions for Nominet, or rather for the replacement of Nominet in terms of the governance of the .uk commercial internet domains.
Which is what Nominet deals with.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, provisions as in if Nominet doesn't do what it's told, doesn't sort of conform to the standards that the government believes it's set in the Act, then it can be taken out of the equation.
Well, Nominet itself is not mentioned. What is mentioned is if there is not an adequate industry-led solution in place, government will step in and replace it. And that was put in place, depending upon whom you believe, and this of course goes back to the Internet Co-Regulation book where I talk about this, but this was put in place in order to strengthen the hand of the non-commercial interests within Nominet, to threaten commercial stakeholders with the removal of Nominet altogether if they got too greedy.
Hold on to the hand of Nurse for fear of something worse.
Exactly.
We've seen actually just very recently another example where this co-regulation hasn't worked because there was the vague threat from government but nothing concrete in place. So the Do Not Track standard that the World Wide Web Consortium has been trying to develop in this kind of multi-stakeholder process, bringing together the advertising industry, the browser manufacturers, the open source coders, and
this
the privacy
behavioural targeted advertising.
The privacy advocates to allow people to say, I don't want my web browsing tracked, you know, I'm not interested in behavioural adverts. Actually, that process is falling apart now because while governments have said we want this to happen, they haven't really put enough pressure on the advertising industry to say this is what will happen if you can't come to an agreement. So now we see in that working group basically the advertising industry setting just impossible demands from the perspective of the browser companies and the privacy advocates.
Should we say one thing that co-regulation isn't? Because I've had it said to me, well, you're providing an excuse for government to get together with industry and come up with some kind of neo-corporatist solution.
Which has happened a lot in this field.
But when that happens, that's typically where government has been in cahoots with a self-regulatory scheme by industry. So where there is actually a legislative element in place, it means that you also need to have standards for judicial review, standards for consumer representation, standards for appeal. All the kind of things that you may remember the Digital Economy Act was accused of not having in place. And so we say co-regulation cannot be some cop-out whereby government and industry can go off into a smoke-emptied room and come up with a kind of neo-corporatist solution.
It
has to involve
smoking indoors in Belgium.
Oh well, there we are.
Only in some places. But I mean, we started this thread talking about censorship, and you say repeatedly in the book that part of the problem with online censorship is it has been effectively privatised. It has been left to industry, and we don't have due process. We don't have any review. So, I mean, there's a system here in the UK called Clean Feed. Could you just describe what Clean Feed does and why that may be problematic?
So the internet industry, under extreme pressure from the Metropolitan Police in London and the UK government back in the 90s to remove images of child abuse from their servers, set up a body called the Internet Watch Foundation. That will take reports from people and from internet users who've come across child abuse images. If those images are hosted in the UK, the IWF will make sure they're taken down. But if they're hosted outside the UK, this is where Clean Feed comes in. This is a system British Telecom developed, which will take the list of illegal content from the Internet Watch Foundation.
So this is a list of URIs?
This is a list of web addresses of images, of illegal images, and then they will block access to it. And of course, because BT is the internet wholesaler to a whole range of other smaller ISPs in the UK, that has a very broad impact right across the UK. Nobody would disagree with the aim of trying to stop child abuse, of course. The problem comes if you have, as we do in this case, secret lists of content which is according to the IWF illegal. The people hosting the content aren't given the opportunity to contest that.
But surely that's fine, because if I try to access a website that's on this list, I'll get a little form that comes up and said, blocked by BT Clean Feed, you can't go here, and here's a reason it will link to an appeals page. Everything surely is above board when it comes to it.
And the problem is, of course, that none of those things are in place for most internet service providers, that usually it will just look to the user like they've made a mistake and the page doesn't exist, so they don't have an opportunity to appeal. Actually, ironically, Saudi Arabia, which has a similar scheme, does a better job of making sure that users know what's going on.
I should say there's three other problems which emerge from this. The first, of course, CleanFeed is the British telecom technology, and there is a generic list which the IWF can generate for its members, its member ISPs, which they can then use for their own versions of CleanFeed, whatever it might be. So TalkTalk has a more intrusive list, a more censorious list, and so on. But the problems that emerge from that are, first of all, this is a fairly limited technology. Where British Telecom always said that they could probably block about 10,000 URIs in total, and that there were, in terms of child abuse, something in the low thousands. The problem emerges then, well, this system's already in place. So when courts have been asked to decide what they want to do about blocking access to BitTorrent or Pirate Bay or Mega Upload, which I don't think was ever found illegal in this country, and so on, they are then faced with this position where British Telecom and all the other major ISPs have shown how cost-efficiently they can block access. And so the courts have said there is therefore nothing disproportionate about imposing these blocks. And when that's done, and this brings me on to the third point very quickly, lawyers always have 3 points, as you know, but the third point is that Sky was blocking access to one of these sites which was claimed to be carrying a great deal of pirated material. Bear in mind there's no appeal in these situations, it just happens. When they did that, it turned out that the problem was the blocking they were using was blocking very, very many websites that were actually sharing a similar URI. So in actual fact, there was this collateral damage that was very extensive. And these kinds of problems always arise when you have filtering.
Listening to Little Atoms with me, Becky Hogg, and guest presenter Bill Thompson, and tonight we're talking to Ian Brown and Chris Marston about regulating code. Let's move on to social networks, which is the fourth topic that you take on in your book, and services like Facebook in particular. You call this the perfect example of an unregulated environment. Could you tell us a bit more about that and the effect it has, for example, on users and on user privacy? Ian's pointing to Chris like it was his idea.
They're clearly both so keen to take this one on. Obviously, both worried about being blocked from Facebook after this broadcast.
We're tag teaming. Well, actually, Ian voluntarily left, which actually is actually the exception to the general point, which is that if you're locked into a website, I'm using an economic term, if you use a website like Facebook, and so do your friends and your colleagues and your parents and every Tom, Dick and Harry in the world is on Facebook these days, then the network effect involved there is a much stronger effect than it simply is if you're using the telephone system and somebody else's, because it's a group effect. And so you're in a situation where you're actually, if you want to leave Facebook, you'd like to take not only all of your data with you, which is an issue that we might talk about in a moment, but also how can you take your whole community with you? So there's a real problem there, and this is beside the obvious point that I think probably all listeners know about, which is that Facebook has been guilty of various abuses of the privacy of their users, and of course that Facebook privacy policies are very much a moving target.
Well, but Facebook would surely argue they're just trying to do the best for everyone, and they have to be flexible in a rapidly changing environment, and nobody's forced to be there.
Facebook, this will interest I think people to know, is regulated in Europe from Port Arlington in County Louth in Ireland. Facebook only has one regulator across the whole of Europe. So for all 27 member states, there is one regulator. That regulator is in a very small town, which actually recently was the subject of the Irish State Broadcaster's town makeover programme. Because the town is such a has a poor reputation, shall we say.
You're talking about the Irish Information Commissioner, is that right?
The Irish Data Protection Supervisor, exactly, moved out to Port Arlington from Dublin in 2006. And so this is where your data is regulated from across Europe. So whenever you hear about German regulators being very upset about Facebook and others, ultimately the regulator of Facebook in Europe is the Irish Data Protection Supervisor in Port Arlington. And so it's really for Facebook to talk to the Irish regulator in Port Arlington, and for the 400 million or 300 million, however many there are today, users of Facebook in Europe, we have to look to the Irish Data Protection Supervisor to protect us in terms of our privacy. I hope that makes everyone feel comfortable.
And we should say that the English data protection, or sorry, the UK Information Commissioner lives somewhere equally unglamorous, with apologies to listeners in, is it?
Wilmslow,
that's it.
Wilmslow's pretty glamorous, I think.
Wilmslow is baby Bentley country, exactly, for Manchester United and various other football persons.
You know that all the fees we pay to register our data policies are going to support an office in Wilmslow.
Isn't,
but I suppose
that nice?
the point is, even though the relationship between the European regulator and Facebook is as asymmetrical as you refer to there, actually, particularly given new data protection regulations coming online in Europe, it's very likely that Facebook, as it's currently constituted, actually won't be able to operate in Europe unless it changes radically. You lay out a number of provisions in this chapter about social networks to which Facebook can't possibly comply.
Well, I think, first of all, we'll have to see what the revised data protection law looks like once the European Parliament has finished looking at the 4,000 amendments that have been tabled by
and
members of
Parliament.
And once
the US government and US companies,
which US companies have been very, very heavily involved with. So I'm sure Facebook and the other big internet companies may get more out of this data protection law than we think. But secondly, one of the reasons I think it's very worthwhile the European Union regulating is because it's a marketplace of 500 million rich consumers. It's not somewhere that the internet multinationals can afford to ignore. Whereas if we had the individual 27 countries trying to make these laws for themselves, of course, it would be perfectly feasible for a Facebook to ignore a medium-sized European country. So I really don't think it's as hard for these big companies to comply with some of these regulations as is sometimes claimed.
Okay, can I offer just a bit of a health warning for people out there? So people will be conscious that, because it's in the news all the time at the moment, that the European Parliament is negotiating, as Ian was saying, these many, many amendments to what's proposed to be a regulation that would be implemented across Europe that would replace or at least supplement the existing directive. This will not take effect. This will not have teeth until 2016 or 2017. This is years away. And in the meantime, the regulator that's actually taking action, and this is why we say that this is a much more nuanced and a much more complex position than we expect, is the US Federal Trade Commission, which has been fining both Google and Facebook very large amounts, just over $20 million each over the last year, and has implemented a system whereby they're actually going to have an audit of all new products that Google has. This is in the wake of the Google Buzz and some of the other problems that Google has.
So Buzz was Google's first attempt at a social network after a coup, that when they released it, they automatically signed everybody up into your friendship circles, and by doing that exposed a lot of connections that people might have wanted to keep private.
Exactly. We all found ourselves on Google Buzz, whether we thought we were going to be on it or not. And so the US regulator has been finding these companies and has implemented a 20-year settlement with each, whereby they conduct a privacy audit every 2 years of the companies. So it sounds a little bit odd, given that we're saying that Europe should be taking more action and Europe has the ability to take more action on these areas, when I then tell you the regulator for Europe is in Port Arlington and isn't doing a great deal yet. We have hopes, some hopes. Whereas the US regulator, where they don't have a generic privacy law, is actually taking action. So sometimes you have to look behind the law and look at the actual reality of the enforcement.
So, and is that because in the US the concerns are largely commercial and market driven, and in Europe we tend to look more to sort of social justice, moral rights and privacy as some, as a human rights issue? And for Google and Facebook to trample over people's private data actually has a commercial impact in the US, and therefore is seen as being something which is of commercial relevance, or is there something else going on there?
I think there's a couple of interesting things to unpack from that. The first is the reason why these settlements were so large and why the FTC has taken, the Federal Trade Commission has taken so much action on this, is actually because of the fact that there were these class action suits, which the Americans are very keen on and which do protect the consumer much more effectively than in Europe. In Europe, we tend to go for more generic legislation and hope that that will work. So that's an interesting outcome. It's actually the aggressive class action suit which resulted in these settlements. But in terms of the fact that we take a moral kind of moral high ground or a more human rights approach, well, I mean, up to a point.
Also, the point is that a lot of these companies, Google, Facebook, aren't created in the European Union, so European regulators feel they have a much clearer hand to deal at regulation. Is that fair to say?
Oh, a hometown decision.
Yeah.
that we can afford to regulate these guys because they're actually not they're not performing
well,
the shares in the UK.
Well, Google hasn't paid any tax in this country, right?
Well, Google again is regulated from Ireland. That's another Port Arlington client. Amazon obviously is a Luxembourg company, as is eBay when it comes to
this
Europe.
This is mainly to do with tax purposes rather than privacy regulation at this stage.
Although I suspect with companies like Google and Facebook, where personal data is a big part of the business, that this is an important secondary but not completely secondary consideration for them.
Well, actually glossing over your initial point, Chris, which put simply was, if you're not on Facebook, you don't get invited to parties. Which I think a lot of our listeners, and possibly Ian as well, who's left Facebook, can sympathise with. And this is quite a key point in this chapter and subsequent chapters, that actually interoperability and the ability to leave and take your data with you to another service is something that you're putting forward quite strongly.
And more than that, not just take your data with you, which European politicians are absolutely talking about putting into law, but to be able to connect back to your friends that are still in that community. Because, of course, especially with social networking sites, the whole point is to share and to communicate with your friends. And if you're on, you know, there are lots of great, much more privacy-friendly social networking sites out there.
Feel free to mention a few.
But so Diaspora is an interesting example of some software that's been developed, much more distributed system, but how many people are on it? You know, you move over there and you sort of hear the tumbleweed.
And actually, although taking your friends and communicating back with your friends may sound like a sort of rare and wonderful dreamland, it's no different to being able to telephone anyone you want on any mobile network, essentially.
Or send an email.
Yeah.
And we should say that this comes back to a bit of history on this. AOL, when it merged with Time Warner back in 1999-2000, they had a condition placed on the merger, which was that they had to have interoperability between AOL Instant Messenger and other Instant Messenger services because of the worry about the fact that a dominant network could be forming and that they might not be allowing you to, as it were, interconnect between networks. The interconnection interoperability point is very technical, and we talk about that a bit in the book. But I just want to say one other thing, which is that it's really interesting. Competition law, in general, has nothing to say about a company like Facebook or Google. Google has just been given a very clean bill of health by the American regulators. It's received a fairly good bill of health from the European regulators as well. And that's because these are considered to be dynamic, very fast-moving industries where you don't have long-term dominance. If you remember the Microsoft case, the idea was Microsoft will not have long-term dominance. And it's possible, of course, that as we move towards smartphones and tablets, it won't do. But it's been 20 years and they've been doing rather well for a long time. So competition law doesn't work. And we make an argument about the fact that we need to move into a much more sophisticated understanding of these markets. Otherwise, competition regulators just say, not our problem. Because this is only Facebook was not the biggest 5 years ago. And so who knows where we'll be in 5 years' time? Well, I think I know where we'll be in 5 years' time. I think we'll be locked into Facebook.
Yeah. I want to talk quickly, and it's going to be hard to talk quickly about this because it is your specialist subject to which you've dedicated at least the last decade of study. That's net neutrality, which is the last sort of case study that you both take on, although I imagine Chris's work's been was a big driver for it. You say that telecommunications regulation in this sphere is in a state of advanced capture. What do you mean by that?
Well, and I should say that actually, as with all the chapters, one of the nice things about writing a net neutrality chapter with Ian, as hopefully for Ian writing a privacy chapter with me, is that we actually get to write something a bit fresher than if we were just, updating our old stuff. But in terms of the capture that takes place here, it's just very, very... Telecom companies never liked the internet. Famously, when Paul Barron first went to AT&T, the big American telecom company, and said, here's the idea for a packet switch network, Jack Osterman, who was the head of AT&T, said, first, it won't work, and second, even if it does, damned if we're going to create a competitor to ourselves.
That worked.
And so, yes, well, he was right. They were creating a competitor to themselves. It's why they were trying to get rid of it for so long.
It was a good insight.
And this is actually, this is now 51 years ago this conversation took place. So this is a very, you know, you can track net neutrality back as far as you want. And I start talking about railways and all kinds of earlier versions of networks that deal with this. But the advanced state of capture is particularly apparent when you look at the fact that we are caught in this, in Europe, most of Europe, and particularly in Britain, even though we talk about super fast broadband.
100% super fast broadband.
Oh, 100% super fast broadband. How magnificent. Which is fibre to the curb. So when we talk about having things like fibre to the curb, we do have a situation where, and I should say British Telecom is not particularly naughty about this, some other companies are much worse about it. They will say, well, if you're going to regulate us, we're not going to make the investment, and if we're not going to make the investment, you're not going to get super fast broadband. So politicians who like league tables, they like to say Britain is going to have the most, what is it, the most competitive and broadly provisioned super fast broadband in Europe by 2015. This is the very odd election pledge that's been made by the Culture Ministry over a period of time, not just by the current minister. So they like the league tables. And if this means that, you know, those pirates out there, whoever you might be, waving your skull and crossbones, have your bandwidth throttled by the company instead of through due process of law, well, ministers might not be so upset.
Yeah, because there's a dual agenda here, isn't there? It's, you know, the ISPs on the one hand want to use privacy-invading deep packet inspection technology to deliver faster internet speeds on certain service levels. At the same time, that same technology can be used to inspect packets for security purposes, to combat piracy. Those agendas are converging in what you call... I thought I'd written it down.
I often use the term perfect storm when it comes to this.
There we go, yes, exactly. A security industrial complex.
As opposed to the military industrial complex or the entertainment industrial complex.
We have many complexes in life, as we know. But it's worth bearing in mind that when we have a chapter on filtering, which is about state censorship, or rather state-induced censorship. So we talk about WikiLeaks being, to some extent, knocked back by Senator Joe Lieberman convincing Amazon and others to stop either taking payments or having cloud services that hosted WikiLeaks back at the time of the leaking of the great many cables that were still currently, of course, tragically, Bradley Manning is awaiting proper trial for. So that was the chapter about state-induced. Net neutrality, or smart pipes as we call it, is the chapter about corporate-induced censorship. And so these are two sides of the same coin in many ways.
When do we get to talk about freedom then?
Well, freedom is what we talk about in all of the chapters as being the alternative to where we currently sit. But of course, freedom does rely upon governments doing the right thing to make companies do the right thing.
You're listening to Little Atoms with Becky Hogg and me, Bill Thompson. And tonight we're talking to Ian Brown and Chris Marsden, authors of Regulating Code.
And we've just got on to my favourite topic, the topic of freedom. Actually, in the last chapter, you talk about some of the recent multi-stakeholder regional events like the OECD meeting, and people use freedom to mean lots of different things. You talk about individual freedoms being at risk from what I finally discovered is the security industrial complex currently lobbying governments on regulation. Can we speak a bit about that?
So I think you have a very long philosophy and political debate about what the nature of freedom, what is it to be free, and actually it goes back quite strongly to the differing regulatory cultures of the US versus Europe and much of the rest of the world, where the US you have a very strong negative conception of freedom, that freedom is all about stopping the government make you do things, and that's all there is to it.
Surely freedom's just another word for no packets being dropped.
Constraining the government, whereas Europe has more of a positive conception of freedom, which is to say, yes, there are some things governments should not do unless there's a sort of a very good requirement for it, like censorship, but at the same time there are some freedoms, like privacy very much in the internet context, where you need some state action to actually make those effective for individuals. One of the issues with the security industrial complex, of course, here it really is a classic state issue, because it's powerful interests within government, the Home Offices and the intelligence agencies who will always have a receptive audience in senior politicians, alongside the very large defence contractors now that have seen internet security and surveillance as a cash cow, who see, okay, well, maybe the Cold War is fading into history, here's where we'll be making our next £1 billion in profit. If we can make government force ISPs to buy all this incredibly expensive deep packet inspection equipment for their networks so that government can keep tabs on everyone you're not just talking to on your phone, not just emailing, but everyone you talk to on your social networking sites, you're tweeting to, your voice over IP software, your virtual worlds, your gaming. In fact, even 5 or 6 years ago, I heard from a government official, they estimated in the UK alone, there were something like 450 billion communications events every year, and they wanted to know about all of them.
And still do. We should add, actually, that it's not just about government stopping companies doing bad things or stopping doing stupid things themselves or particularly bad things, whether it's communications, data retention, or whatever else it might be, but it's also about the fact that governments can do good things. So I'll give you an example. If you add up all of the spending that government has on IT, that's from the NHS to the police to local government to central government to the MOD to every part of government, this is actually the majority of IT spending in the UK. And if you go across Europe, it's the same situation. The majority of spending on IT is carried out by governments. And so the European Commission came up many years ago with something called the European Interoperability Framework. They've now got a version 2 of the framework, and no doubt a version 3 will follow in a couple of years' time. The nub of this is basically there's three things. First of all, there's the thing about getting companies to interoperate. So from Microsoft onwards, and in fact the commissioner responsible made a strong statement that they don't want an epic competition case every single time they want companies to interoperate. But it's got other things in it that are really good ideas. Like if government is spending the majority of all IT spending in our country, if they were to insist on interoperability in the systems they were buying, that would tip the whole of the market over to more interoperable systems. What a good idea. So instead of never being fired for buying Microsoft or never being fired for buying SAP, if perhaps you could be fired if you were buying systems that weren't interoperable enough, that can make a big difference. And I should say that another thing the government's very involved in is recognising interoperable standards and not allowing companies to use proprietary standards to stop innovation happening.
And I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but those people who say that, oh, the internet is the perfect environment, governments should stay out of it, are ignoring the fact that actually it was government intervention that began. You were only allowed to connect any device you wanted to the telephone network because government regulated, when the government was selling off the telecoms industry, they said they had to let anyone connect to their networks.
Yes, absolutely. And it should be said that every network communication that we've had has relied upon regulation at least for ensuring that you have access to the network as a user or as a rival company. But in actual fact, to say government shouldn't be involved with the internet, I think is actually doing a disservice to the internet. The internet doesn't just permeate all our lives, it actually permeates every aspect of the services that we ask for from companies and from governments. And we expect to be able to use the internet for such an enormous range of activities that we engage in every day. It would be a bit like saying, let's keep government off road safety.
I suppose the problem is that when people have seen government intervene on the internet, they've seen them intervene on behalf of corporate stakeholders, for example, as we've discussed in the copyright debate.
And that's absolutely... I think governments have not helped themselves here because they've been so cack-handed in quite a broad range of trying to regulate, you know, both on the security side with the voices from the sort of authoritarian parts of government playing such a key role, and also, as you said, Becky, in areas like copyright where they seem to be so captured by industry, they really weren't listening to the user and to the user groups and user representatives, so they were pushing very one-sided rules through Parliament.
You coined a phrase there, the objectification of the citizen, which is essentially what happened in both of those instances. The citizen was someone that had to be stopped, either from infringing on copyright or from discussing things or accessing information they shouldn't.
And we have to be very careful because too many of these debates are framed in terms of discussions between, say, the intellectual property lobby and the internet service providers, the telcos. And we call ourselves the prosumers, which is the European jargon for producers and consumers.
But you do admit it's a horrible word.
A prosumer is a horrible word, but it's what we do. My mother actually said to me, am I a prosumer as well? And I said, Mum, if you update your status on Facebook, you're producing as well as consuming. And she said, oh, I hoped I wasn't. But nevertheless, we all are prosumers. And I think that it's really, really important that citizens don't get left out of the argument. I should tell you something horrific when you come to deal with these policies very closely, and Bill and Becky, you both know about these things anyway, the number of people in Parliament with any real awareness about information technology is shockingly low.
Yes.
Horrendously low.
In the UK Parliament, but in any Parliament that I've encountered, in any legislature, it is the case.
The only parliamentarian I've met over the last couple of years who I've really thought really gets this is a German member of Parliament called Jimmy Schultz, who's an internet entrepreneur who then went into Parliament. And I should say, obviously, I've met some pirate party people as well, and we'll... That's a discussion for another day. Clearly, they know about technology as well.
Birgitta is a poet, really, and only a parliamentarian and a technologist in the secondary sense.
So right.
Can I sort of try to step back just a little bit? So, in the book, it's called Regulating Code, and you define explicitly that code is, you know, the technological basis of the internet. So you're talking about how we manage the internet as an environment which we have designed and have shaped and can choose to change in the Larry Lessig sense of code. And you talk about privacy and data protection, you talk about copyright, censorship, social networking services, and then net neutrality, what you call smart pipes, how you manage. So five very big, broad, hard case studies. In the book, you don't actually give very many answers to the questions. All you end up doing is saying, we need a different process. We need a new process. We need to incorporate more people. Is that because you don't have any answers? You don't think there are any answers? Or because you know what the answer should be, but you think it should be left to the process? Are you just being self-denying?
Well, I would say one of the key arguments we make is that the process is critical, that nobody has the answer, because actually the answer is very dependent on the context and the different stakeholders that are involved. And this is why it's so important to keep coming back to this co-regulation and another horrible word, multi-stakeholderization, that's even worse than prosumer, making sure all the interests are at the table when the rules are being set. It may, you know, it's slightly abstract. It's perhaps not as gritty as, you know, the great internet policy arguments about digital rights management, for example, but it's the process really is critical. But I think we do make a number of specific recommendations. Also, one, we've talked about the interoperability in ways that governments, through perhaps competition law, could much more strongly enforce that in future. And again, what we're saying there is that the value of a sort of a competitive approach is you don't say any one stakeholder has the perfect approach. You know, it's not that government can write a very detailed law saying exactly how everything should be and everyone will follow it, because we know that just won't work in practice. But if you have businesses competing to give people what they want, so people are very fond of social networking sites, that's great. If you're one of those people for whom privacy is really important, well, wouldn't it be great if you could find the social networking site that gave you that privacy but didn't cut you off from all of your friends?
As government puts it, or at least as the UK government's Behavioural Insights Unit puts it, how do we nudge people towards better solutions? And one of the ways that you have to do that is by underpinning the regime that encourages companies to give people incentives to actually take care of their privacy. And that may be against companies' own best interests. Can I just quickly say why we call them hard cases? We call them hard cases because there is no regulatory regime in place in these various cases we look at where you can say there's an Internet Watch Foundation, there's a Nominet, there's some kind of organisation which is taking care of the issue. And the reason why there isn't an organisation taking care of any of these five issues is because the interests of different stakeholders are diametrically opposed to each other. And so government has to do something. It has to umpire the game or allow, you know, Facebook to set all of the rules for social networking or to allow the big telcos to set all of the rules for net neutrality. So that's why we call them hard cases. And in fact, one of the things that we do at the beginning of the book is that we make clear that the idea that we can all encrypt everything was a beautiful idea, that somehow all we have to do is make ourselves anonymous, prevent ourselves being tracked, and we solve all of the problems that we might have in many of these different areas. And of course it doesn't work because we're lazy. And many of us, like me, are lawyers or other people who are uninformed about technology and just don't do these things. And so the solutions we have to come up with have to work for everybody, or at least for the great mass of people, and it's not just for the specialists.
It's not laziness, it's the fact that governance of geeks, by geeks, for geeks, might work for geeks, but geeks are still a pretty small percentage.
Said it, I was just feeling my little heart swell. I could get behind that mission.
But we want people who aren't geeks to get the benefits of this. You shouldn't have to understand how to use PGP and encrypt everything and use Tor and so on to have the first hope of protecting your privacy. That's, you know, not, we shouldn't just abandon the masses to the sort of the maws of the market and say we geeks will look after ourselves.
As you say it, though, it does sound a much simpler solution.
Well, if we all walked around in disguises all day, closed-circuit TV cameras wouldn't work so effectively. But, you know, we don't do
different
that typically.
Different disguises all day. Different
yes,
disguises
you're right. Changing our disguise day to day. That's
swapping them randomly with other people.
But I should say, I mean, look, we don't think we're being radical. We're considered to be radical in some ways in what we're suggesting here. But the solutions that we're talking about coming up with, solutions that actually are technologically literate, which actually take care of fundamental rights, which actually consider the prosumer or the citizen, whatever we want to call ourselves, these should not be radical. And yet, in Westminster or in Brussels, they are considered radical ideas. The copyright chapter. We are authors. It's £27.95 or whatever Amazon charges for it. We believe in copyright to some extent, in as much as I've just received my first royalty check. So don't
the
please...
The beards are on you.
You know, this is not, you know, this is not the Pirate Party manifesto. This is just saying, can we have more sensible policy making that's somewhat technologically literate?
And yet the ideas are greeted as radical.
Well, and the question is that too much to ask? And then you look at parliamentarians and you think, well, yes, perhaps it is.
The ideas you're putting forward are calling for a reasoned debate based around evidence. Now, a friend of mine who works at the very same government, the nudge unit that you just talked about, pointed out to me that ministers seem quite keen on evidence-based policy when it's stuff they don't care about. But as soon as it's something they have an opinion on, then it doesn't matter what the evidence is, they'll do the thing that their gut tells them to. And this is a constant problem. Here, you're calling for reasoned debate where you have massive power blocks arraigned on either side with enormous vested interests. So aren't you just being naive fools to propose this?
Not at all. We one of the key things we say is actually we need to make, first of all, constraints on those power blocks effective. So that's why we focus so much on human rights laws, which constrain governments, and on competition, which should stop the big monopolies coming into effect. But also, absolutely, we say, yes, you have to watch out for policy-based evidence making, absolutely. That's one reason you want civil society involved, so they can sort of say that the emperor has no clothes. But sometimes it's not just a question of rationality, and if only everyone could just look at the evidence, the solution would be obvious. Often, fundamentally, these are political issues where the interests, as Chris said, of different parties are diametrically opposed, and you need political processes to sort those out.
And I should say, Bill, there's a wonderful example where you have some real roadblocks. These are hard cases. So let's take a roadblock. And I should say I've done a lot of policy wonkery, impact assessments for the European Commission and things which are so tedious they'd make the paint peel off the wall. But one of the things that we worked on was the issue about applying television rules to the internet. This was a big European policy almost 10 years ago now. And at the time, I was doing some work for various European Commission, Ofcom and others. And one of the fascinations is where you have these power blocks banging against each other, often there's an impasse, and government actually does look for experts to advise them on how to get through the impasse.
Impartial experts.
You'd hope they would be impartial experts. I don't know if I was. I hope I was. I hope I am. Maybe that really is being naive.
I love the idea of the nudge unit. I should mention in the book you talk about both nudge-nudge regulation and wink-wink regulation, but let's not go there now since we've only got 5 minutes
and we
left
talk about
the show
nudge,
and
we talk about nudge,
hard to explain.
We talk about nudge as fudge
nudge
as well.
We should mention before the show, before we come to a close, because you do mention his work quite often in the book, and that's Tim Wu, and who's author of The Master Switch, and even we had on the show a couple of years ago talking about that and about the cycles that technology and industry go through. There's a burst of innovation, then things crystallise, and you get what we argued earlier, your Google, your Facebook. But the argument you're making at the end of the book is actually a very positive one, which is that you reject that. In part, you reject Wu, as you write, and in fact you feel that multi-stakeholderism, interoperability, some of the ideas that we've talked about can actually help us break through that.
Well, we don't reject at all, the sort of the top level messages from Tim's book. What we say is actually Tim thinks you need a very radical government intervention to say, you know, you really separate out different parts of businesses to stop these big monopolists forming. What we say is we think there are less interventionist solutions actually on interoperability and the other things we talk about, so that you know we're not calling for Facebook to be broken up as AT&T was broken up in the US. We're saying if Facebook had to be interoperable with other social networking services, you would have competition and choice. That's, you know, it's not at all radical, really, in what we're calling for there.
I should say Tim is probably the exception to the rule about a lot of American lawyers writing about libertarian solutions or solutions which don't rely on the state. Tim actually, his separations principle, which is his conclusion to the book, talks about not allowing vertically integrated companies, so not allowing an internet service provider to host content, for instance. And we don't go as far as Tim. You might say that we're a little more cautious than Tim, but then we're Europeans, and we Europeans are supposed to be cautious, I suppose. But I should say that we've been accused of going too far and not far enough in the book. So first of all, people have said to us, interoperability is all very well and good. It's not going to work. Facebook ain't going to do it. Port Arlington isn't going to regulate them. 1 billion people are still going to be on Facebook in 5 years' time, and they're still going to be subject to these policies. So what are you going to do about Facebook now? In other words, it's a fundamental rights issue. This is a monopoly. You must do something. And you're copping out by saying you can have solutions involving competition law and interoperability. And on the other hand, we've had people saying to us, don't touch the internet. If you get governments involved in the internet, with the best will in the world, they will do stupid things like the Digital Economy Act. And you're basically just setting up a recipe for disaster here. And so, you know, I'm sure that both of those criticisms have some value. We're conscious that we're not going to please everybody with the book. That's perhaps one of the points to the book, is to arouse some controversy. And if people have finished the book and throw it at us, then we'll understand that they're from one of those two positions.
You've been listening to Little Atoms with me, Becky Hogg, and my guest host, Bill Thompson. We've been talking to Ian Brown and Chris Marsden about their book Regulating Code, which is out now on MIT Press. Chris, Ian, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Liz Lichtendorf from The Pod Delusion. You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Becky Hogg and Bill Thompson and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms. If you'd like to donate a little money to help support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.